Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. This is Ellie Steele. And we are, hang on one second here. Tonight we're going to delve into the, I'm not really sure here what we would call it tonight, but maybe just give me a second. I started off a little late. And there's a lot of things going on now, and they're really kind of ticked me off over time lately. It's rather difficult to it's kind of difficult for me to summarize what my feelings are right now. And I'm, I got over this recently. I've been reworking my book because being republished by Open Books Media, publishers, Escape Media rather, and I'm really kind of excited about this, and in the sense that it's how can I say, it's something new, in that I'm when you start to revise something that's already published, to kind of re-edit, but also revise and update it, you tend to gain perspective in a sense that you're not lost, but you don't realize how fast time goes, I guess is what I'm getting at, and you don't realize how quickly you go through how quickly your life goes, I guess what I'm trying to say is that in the evolution of a work, we find that just as in life, we find ourselves, or at least I find myself. I hate to use generalities, but we tend to find ourselves, myself, in a position of is a rather uncomfortable position, really, because it's looking back at yourself or looking back at your accomplishment or achievement or whatever it may be that you've done. You have a tendency to be extremely critical of yourself, more so than most people probably would be. When I wrote the book Naked at the Mic, I was considering all of the problems that I saw and faced, and putting on as I got into this business of broadcasting, though it's on a minimal, it's not on a major scale in a sense of, major networks or anything. But I am on a commercial radio station that, has a 750,000 person coverage area. And I've been able to stay on as a radical talk show host for, almost 8 years now. And in reflecting upon that, as well as the television and television programs and 400 of them, as well as documentaries, I have a, you have a unique perspective in the sense that you have video documents and audio documents of where you've actually been and what you've covered and people you've talked to and information that you've disseminated and all of these really unique perspectives. But yet, they're also, it's also empowering as that may be in regards to your own personal journey or your own personal perspective and your own personal history. You see where you made your mistakes. You see fine moments where you did very well, and you see moments where you virtually failed, and then other moments where you know, but they're all on screen. They've all been recorded. They've all been, you know, people have listened to it, and then others. And in that regard, I believe I have succeeded, you know, and I take a lot of not pride, but a lot of solace in knowing that I did, that at least I do. And when I can look and see how many people are listening to this program or have listened to this program or how many people are listening to all the other programs that we did. And we, you know, it's rather humbling to know that you've made that a significant impression on someone, and you've conveyed a specific knowledge to someone, though it may be personal or it may be general or it may be a situation or something that you wanted to bring focus to. Whatever it was, it's extremely important to the people that I focused on, as well as to the people who received that information. And in so doing that, I realized how difficult it was to present your word, present yourself, present your ideas to the public. Because it's like everybody has their own opinion, you know, but you know, what can I say? There are those who have an uninformed opinion and those who have an informed opinion. An informed opinion, a knowledgeable or, you know, opinions are the ones that generate the listeners and create an audience and, people who either agree with you or disagree with you, but at least they continue to listen to you because, or tell their friends about you, or you know, some way they have a personal connection to what you're saying, and that's incredibly important to acknowledge, and I wanted to. I always try to express my thanks to those people who are listening to me, because it means, you know, I'm putting this out there, and I'm trying to put out some great stuff, and I'm seeing people responding to it, and it's a wonderful thing, because I know that I'm, you know, serving humanity, I guess, in my own way. But as being cantankerous as I am, and as independently minded, I know that much of what I say may be over the top, or, you know, over the bottom, or somewhere in the middle. But nevertheless, I try to bring something of relevance to my audience each week. and I don't know, maybe I might fail, but I continue to try. There's an essay tonight that I wanted to get into, and I feel it may be a little too long for this program. And it's an Emerson essay. And I'm going to see if I may not, you know, I was thinking what I might do is just I don't know if I've read this before. I have to search my records, but Emerson did an interesting essay, and again, it's long. Unfortunately, so much of his work, you know, is not brief. One of the great things that he wrote, which I always kind of admired, was his essay on books. And he also wrote an essay on farming, you know, and essays on so many things. But his essay on books, I thought I might get into tonight. I doubt if I'll be able to finish it because it's rather lengthy. But the reason that I was thinking of this was because I read an article recently, and of course my book is out, and my book will be soon re-released in an e-book form through Open Books. The publisher said January, as long as we can continue to make the revisions in time. But my book now is, by the way, is available on Amazon.com or iUniverse.com. You can go to Amazon.com. You can get a 10% discount on that. That is available in print form. It's also available in a downloadable e-book, but I believe it's only the iUniverse is not set up with the nooks or the crannies or the Kindles, you know. So I just recommend the other, which would be the print version, and of Naked at the Mic, and I've had a number of reviews on it, and they've all been very good, and I'm very pleased, and others have been shocked by it, and, you know, but that's good, because that was the key to the idea behind the book. But anybody who's ever penned or authored a book has knows, especially a nonfiction book that's based on a lot of documentation and a lot of personal experiences and so on and so forth, it's a very difficult thing to write, because you're not really creating a character. You're creating history. You know, you're documenting history, you know, as it occurs, and you try to be accurate in your presentation, even though you know you're biased to the extent that you know, you can't be totally objective in any circumstances. You know, the human being is biased. But I say that under the circumstances as a writer, people really don't want objective books. They want books that state something important. And books of timely significance, or books of history, books of philosophy, books of history, books of poetry, books of art, you know, whatever, you know, fiction and nonfiction alike, regardless of the topic, those that are timeless, those that remain, that become classics, or those that are worthy of great status, and for some reason, beyond the control of the author, because the author, remember, many, like Emerson, has been dead for, I don't know, 150 years. So you know, you have to. Why am I reading something that's over 150 years old? You know, and the reason is because it still has significant relevance, and it cites the great books, the great classics, the great authors, and it. Can I say this? It's worth studying. Anyone who can, whose work outlives his lifetime, right? So, why do people study the life of Christ? Why do they study Socrates? Why do they study Plato? Why do they study Homer and, you know, thousands of authors of timely of historical significance, authors that have created movements, authors that have redefined history, and you know, authors who have I think come to mind, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who totally annihilated communist myth of Russia, you know, and the Stalinist regime that terrorized and butchered, you know, 30 million of its own people, or 20 some odd million of its own people, and it's, you know, and how to glorify that. Well, great authors like Solzhenitsyn, you know, broke through that and recorded the crimes and recorded the emotions and the hatreds and the conflicts of the gulags, which he was in one, you know. So and of course exile and so on. You would just and captured as well the atrocities that man can do. Man's capable of doing, and political systems are capable of doing. And at this point in time, we are so close to that. We are so close to being destroyed as a sovereign nation, as a sovereign people. We're no longer actually sovereign, you know. As individuals with integrity, we're almost at a point of becoming a police state, of our rights being totally infringed upon in this country. We're at a horrible stage of our in our history, where people are being groped and scanned and naked scanners and arrested with no reason, you know, brutally beaten, tasered, bullied, you know, poisoned by pollution and air quality and foods that we eat and vaccinations that we receive. It's a horrible time. And any free-thinking person, any person who has any grasp of history, true history, would be like I am in outraged. It would be outraged as I am. And I feel like I felt in the book that I wrote, Naked at the Mic. My emotions as I write, as I am here tonight, I hold nothing back. I try not to hold anything back from my listeners. I try to present an honest reading or an honest comment about an honest feeling or emotion or thought that I have. And I feel as a broadcaster, it's my duty. It's my my duty. Yeah, it's my profession. It's my integrity on the line, all right, in order to be that way. And I'm certain that those who are listening to me and that my audience has, from the responses I've received over many years, have connected to that honesty that I try to present, and in the works that I try to put forward, and in the authors that I've and writers that I believe truly have inspired me over the years with truth and style and wisdom. And I guess that was enough introduction tonight to where we're going here. But I wanted to tell you that what spurred me to think about this, reading this tonight, and to talk about this issue is because I read an article recently that in the next 5 years, they predict that paper books will no longer be made. Or if they are, they'll be a rarity, and they'll be, you know, for books to be in print. So those of you who have, like I do, you know, hundreds of books of quality or old books, rare books, these books you'll never see again, and unless they, you know, come out in some electronic text, they won't be printed again. And I feel that's such a loss. It's such a great loss to the world just to have them on a digital format. Well, what happens if that digital format is broken? What happens if you smash it? You can't, and you you ruin it. This, all the books and all the things, and it's the same on the power grid, where all of this stuff digitally is lost, could be easily lost. And you know what it's like to have a computer crash. Well, can you imagine having everything digitally dependent totally on digital memories and so on and so forth? And the way that technology advances so quickly and the changes of trying to keep up with it is damn near impossible, all right, for the average human being. And anybody over 50 years old who's trying to retool, okay, you know, can understand that this technology, these computers, this logic, this mathematical binary concepts may be totally lost on you, and as they are on me, you know. I mean, I operate my computer, I edit my videos and things like that, but these are all learning curves. There's always something new and something amazing that is always in, but it's all on a digital format. There's nothing in print, you know. So it would be so easy for all this information to be lost. The only thing that's kept our world together for the last billion, 100,000 years, or however long there's been something in stone or in writing, is because it was on paper, right? It was on paper. It was in a book form or in a manuscript or in some form. I mean, unless there was a book, there would never have been a Bible, right? There would never have been unless things were written down, there would never have been any great works, no literature and history would have been lost. And so much of it already is lost and has been lost over time. But the only records have been these books, you know, and manuscripts and writings and journals and so on. And if a person is serious, as I am, about history and documenting history correctly, and because my degree was in history and English and so on, and I've been a historian most of my life, so to me the documentation of that in writing is a critical service to humanity, right? As well as a critical service saying, what, you know, this is what my book was, and that's why it took 5 years to write, because, and 10 years to live, because, or more, I mean, I have my lifetime to live, but what I put in there was an honest reflection of what I've learned and what I've broadcasted over the years in politics and political events and social events and so on and so forth that are, that I felt were extremely significant in the last 10 years of neocon conservatism that's ruled us, and then the resurgence of liberalism, and then again the decline of that political movement in this election, most recent. So it's critical for us to be able to read, but it's critical for us to be able to have a physical book to read, you know, in our hands, in our laps, you know, that we can refer to at any time we wish. And if there's a power shortage or we're out of a battery, you know, we can't get to see it, you know. The only thing is, you know, at least we can read a book by candlelight, you know. Which is how people read prior to either read in daylight or they read in candlelight, firelight, up until about 100 years ago. So, you know, from all of that, I'm going to, let the next half hour, I'm going to read what Emerson said about books. And for those of you who are familiar with Emerson, and I've spoken about him so many times on the show, he was a great American philosopher and founder of Transcendentalism, and also the original editor of the, and founder of the Dial magazine, very famous during his period and during the 20th century. And his impact on the American mindset, especially in some of his essays called Self-Reliance and so on, he was the force and movement behind the entire movement west in the American spirit of self-reliance, American spirit of the sovereign spirit, you know, who we are, what we are, why we are, and our faults and our weaknesses and our strengths. And but he was the one that told us that we are as good as anybody. Our word is as important as anybody's, right? This is how we say it, who we say it to, you know, can make it weaker or stronger in its presentation. However, it doesn't lessen the degree of wisdom or understanding that we intuitively have, you know, as human beings. So, if I call you wrong in an argument, say you're dead wrong, you say, no, you're dead wrong. Okay. Well, that's our way of, then somebody got to come around the middle and say, hey, what is right? You know, do we really know anything? And one of the greatest statements I ever read, which is one of the cosmic laws, is the all truth is half truth. Your truth and my truth are only half truths. And everything else is, you know, known by God or the greater cosmic mind. So let me go back to this book. And again, it's, this show tonight is based upon an appreciation of books. And I will, and the metaphysical and the cosmic and spiritual essence of a book, right? Which I think is captured quite well in this essay. And again, I will not be able to finish it tonight, but we will. Perhaps I can continue it next week. Books. It is easy to accuse books, and bad ones are easily found, and the best are but records and not the things recorded. And certainly there is dilettanteism. That's a new word for me. There is dilettanteism enough, and books that are merely neutral and, do nothing for us. In Plato's Gorgias, Socrates says, "The shipmaster walks in a modest garb near the sea after bringing his passengers from Aegina or from Apontus, not thinking he has done anything extraordinary, and certainly knowing that his passengers are the same, and in no respect better than when he took them on board." So it is with books, for the most part. They work no redemption in us. The bookseller might certainly know that his customers are in no respect better for the purchase and consumption of his wares. The volume is dear at a dollar, and after reading to weariness the lettered backs, we leave the shop with a sigh and learn, as I did, without surprise, of a surly bank director that in bank parlors they estimate all stocks of this kind as rubbish. But it is not less true that there are books which are of that importance in a man's private experience as to verify for him the fables of Cornelius Agrippa or Michael Scott or of the old Orpheus of Thrace, are books which take rank in our life with parents and lovers and passionate experiences, so medicinal, so stringent, so revolutionary, so authoritative, books which are the work and the proof of faculties, so comprehensive, so nearly equal to the world which they paint, that though one shuts them with meaner ones, he feels an exclusion from them to accuse his way of living. Consider what you have in the smallest chosen library, a company of wisest and wittiest men that could be picked out of all civil countries in 1,000 years, have set in best order the results of their learning and wisdom. The men themselves were hid and inaccessible, solitary, impatient of interruption, fenced by etiquette, but the thought which they did not uncover to their bosom friend, but the thought which they did not uncover to their bosom friend is where written out in the transparent words to us, strangers of another age. We owe to books those general benefits which come from high intellectual action. Thus, I think we often owe to them the perception of immortality. They impart sympathetic activity to the moral power. Go with mean people and you think life is mean. Then read Plutarch and the world is a proud place. Peopled with men of positive quality, with heroes and demigods standing around us who will not let us sleep. Then they address the imagination. Only poetry inspires poetry. They become the organic culture of the time. College education is the reading of certain books which the common sense of all scholars agrees will represent the science already accumulated. If you know that, for instance, in geometry, if you have read Euclid and Laplace, your opinion has some value. If you do not know these, you are not entitled to give you any opinion on the subject. Excuse me. Whenever any skeptic or bigot claims to be heard on the question of intellect and morals, we ask if he is familiar with the books of Plato, where all his pert objections have once for all been disposed of. If not, he has no right to our time. And let him go and find himself answered there. Meantime, the colleges, whilst they provide us with libraries, furnish no professor of books, and I think no chair is so much wanted. In a library, we are surrounded by many hundreds of dear friends, but they are imprisoned by an enchanter in these paper and leathern boxes. And though they know us and have been waiting 2, 10, or 20 centuries for us, some of them, and are eager to give us a sign and unbosom themselves, it is the law of their limbo that they must not speak until spoken to. And as the enchanter has dressed them like battalions of infantry in coat and jacket of one cut by the 1,000 and 10,000, your chance of hitting on the right one is to be computed by the arithmetical rule of permutation and combination. Not a choice out of 3 caskets, but one of 500,000 caskets, all alike. But it happens in our experience that in this lottery, there are at least 50 or 100 blanks to a prize. It seems then as if some charitable soul, after losing a great deal of time amongst the false books and alighting upon a few true ones, which made him happy and wise, would do a right act in naming those which have been bridges or ships to carry him safely over the dark morasses and barren oceans into the heart of sacred cities, into the palaces and temples. This would be best done by those great masters of books who from time to time appear, the Fabrici, the Seldens, the Megalabicis, Scaligers, Mirandolas, Bales, Johnsons, and those eyes whose eyes sweep the whole horizon of learning. But private readers, reading purely for love of the book, would serve us by leaving each the shortest note of what he found. There are books, and it is practical to read them, because they are so few. We look over with a sigh in the monumental libraries of Paris, or the Vatican, and the British Museum. In the Imperial Library at Paris, it is commonly said there are 600,000 volumes and nearly as many manuscripts. And perhaps the number of extant printed books may be as many as these numbers united, or pages which a diligent man can read in a day, and a number of years which human life is in favorable circumstances allows to reading. And to demonstrate that though he should read from dawn until dark for 60 years, he might die in the first alcoves. It's true. It's so true. You can never ever read everything, you know, no matter how fast you read. But nothing can be more deceptive than this arithmetic, where none but a natural method is really pertinent. I visit occasionally the Cambridge Library, and I can seldom go there without renewing the conviction that the best of it all is already within the four walls of my study at home. The inspection of the catalog brings me continually back to the few standard writers who are on every private shelf, and to these it can afford only the most slight and casual additions. The crowd and centuries of books are only commentary and elucidation, echoes and weakeners of these few great voices of time. Man, that's so true. And Emerson is one of those true great voices of time. The best rule of the reading will be a method from nature, and not a mechanical one of hours and pages. It holds each student to a pursuit of his native aim instead of a desultory miscellany. Let him read what is proper to him, not waste his memory on a crowd of mediocrities. As whole nations have derived their culture from a single book, as the Bible has been the literature as well as the religion of large portions of Europe, as Hafiz was eminent genius of the Persians, Confucius of the Chinese, Cervantes of the Spaniards, so perhaps the human mind would be a gainer if all the secondary writers were lost, say in England, but Shakespeare, Milton, and Bacon, through the profounder studies so drawn to those wonderful minds. With this plot of his own genius, let the student read on, or let him read many. He will read advantageously. Dr. Johnson, and assuming he's saying Samuel Johnson, said, "Whilst you stand deliberating which book your son shall read first, another boy has read both. Read anything 5 hours a day, and you will soon be learned." You know what's fascinating was there's a book that I actually an interview I interviewed this author. He wrote a book called Personal Branding, and in it he stated a fascinating fact that I didn't realize until he said it. But if anybody who's read at least 5 books on one subject, on any subject, they are an expert, all right? And they can be considered an expert by the media, okay? If you research a book, or if you research a specific history or a specific angle or a specific author or a specific philosopher, and you've read many of his works, or much of the letters of Jefferson or the works of Emerson, or, you know, then what that makes you is a scholar, basically. A scholar, and therefore an expert, more so than the average man who's never read these people. And you become an authority, and it provides for you to, you know, go out and be authoritative on these issues. And your statements are marked with authority. Your confidence is marked with authority. And, you know, you can be a lecturer, you can be an educator, you know. This is the way it is. And with educators, they learn information and regurgitate it basically back to their students through a standard method of teaching, you know, allowable by the system they teach, and a certain curriculum, you know, and so on and so forth, so that students are getting the basics, you know, that they're required to have as to be competent students, competent citizens, being able to read and write and mathematical abilities and be able to analyze and figure things out. It's not easy to do. And unfortunately, we're kind of losing that today because our educational systems are set up not so much to analyze but to prophesize, you know, it's the way it is and there's no other way. They don't teach you to think for yourself anymore because they don't want you to think for yourself. You either become a Republican or a Democrat, either a Catholic or a Protestant or a Jew or a Muslim or whatever you are. You know, but, you know, you're that and you're told how to think and how to act and who to vote for and what to, you know, you don't have to think for yourself. Everything is all planned. Well, books change all that and authors change all that, right? Because when you read, and if you're a careful reader, you're analyzing, you're criticizing, you're wondering, you're involved, and a good author can take you to places that you've never been before. A good author can depict scenes and history that are vivid and bright. And one of the greatest compliments I received recently about my book was from a young man. He was only 18 years old, and he'd been reading the book and reading the book recently, and he said that he came up to me and said, "Mr. Nato, you know, I've been reading your book, and I really like it. It makes so much sense. I've been listening to your radio show as well, he says, and there's so much stuff you're talking about. I can't believe that you were, I'm fascinated. I'm so grateful that you wrote the book. This was from a young man, and he wasn't trying to score points with me or anything. He was just like impressed. He just came up to me and said and he had to comment that he liked the book. And that was such an honest and genuine reaction that I had to accept that as a truthful compliment. And there are others, friends of mine, who have read the book, who have been very, very generous with praise and have liked the book and liked what I wrote. In fact, one publicly stated that she felt every civics course, this book should be taught in every civics course in the United States. And I thought that was fascinating. And I was truly, truly honored by that statement. But not so much reflecting. I don't want to spend time reflecting on this. We don't have too much time. But essentially, every writer of essence, every writer of importance that I have ever read, and believe me, I've read hundreds of different authors, hundreds of thousands that are so forgettable, and that I've forgotten their names and forgotten the books. But there are those who have so clobbered me, okay, with imagination, with their poetry or their short stories or their novels or their great nonfiction writers or their philosophical writings like Emerson here. There are just so many that have stated so many wonderful, great things that they're truly tapped, I believe, the mind of God. And that's why these books, so many of them, are so long-standing and so and are classics and are, and have millions of books printed. Because people are hungry for this information. Nature is much our friend in this matter. Nature is always clarifying her water and her wine. No filtration can be so perfect. She does the same thing by books as by her gases and plants. There is always a selection in writers, and then a selection from the selection. In the first place, all books that get fairly into the vital air of the world were written by the successful class, by the affirming and advancing class, who utter what tens of thousands feel, though they cannot say. And that's what I felt I did with my own book. There has already been a scrutiny and choice from many hundreds of young pens before the pamphlet or political chapter, which you read in a fugitive journal, comes to your eye. All these are young adventurers who produce their performance to the wise ear of time, who sits and weighs, and 10 years hence out of a million of pages reprints one. And boy, is that true. There's so many out of print books, that just didn't stand. And it may be good, but for some reason time just decided to leave them behind. Again, it is judged, it is winnowed by all the winds of opinion, and what terrific selection has not passed on it before it can be reprinted after 20 years and reprinted after a century. It is as if Minos and Rhadamathus had endorsed the writing. This, 'tis were, therefore, an economy of time to read old and famed books. Nothing can be preserved which is not good, and I know beforehand that the Pindar, Marshall, Terence, Galen, Kepler, Galileo, Bacon, Erasmus, and more will be superior to the average intellect. In contemporaries, it is not so easy to distinguish betwixt notoriety and fame. Be sure, then, to read no mean books. Shun the spawn of the press on the gossip of the hour. Do not read what you shall learn without asking in the street and the drain and the train. Dr. Johnson said he always went into stately shops and good travelers' shops at the best hotels, for though they cost more, they do not cost much more, and there is the good company and the best information. In like manner, the scholar knows that the famed books contained first and last the best thoughts and facts. Now and then, by rarest luck, in some foolish Grub Street, in the gem is the gem we want. But in the best circles, in the best information, if you should transfer the amount of your reading day by day in the newspapers to the standard authors, but who dare speak of such a thing? The three practical rules, then, which I have to offer are: 1. Never read any book that is not a year old. Okay. 2. Never read any but famed books. And 3. Never read any but what you like, or in Shakespeare's phrase, no profit goes where is no pleasure ta'en. In brief, sir, study what you most affect. Montaigne says, books are a languid pleasure, but I find certain books vital and spermatic, not leaving the reader what he was. He shuts the book a richer man. I would never willingly read any others than such, and I will venture, at the risk of indicting a list of old primers and grammars, to count the few books which a superficial reader must thankfully use. As of the old Greek books, I think there are 5 which we cannot spare. 1. Homer, who in spite of Pope and all of the learned uproars of centuries, has really the true fire and is good for simple minds, is the true and adequate germ of Greece, and occupies that place as history, which nothing can supply. It holds through all literature that our best history is still poetry. It is so in Hebrew, in Sanskrit, and in Greek. English history is best known through Shakespeare. And how much through Merlin, Robin Hood, and the Scottish ballads. The German, through the Nibelungen Lied, and the Spanish, through the Cid, or of Homer, George Chapman's is the heroic translation. Through the most literal prose version is the best of all. Herodotus, whose history contains inestimable anecdotes, which brought it with the learned into a sort of disesteem. But in these days, when it is found that what is most memorable of history is a few anecdotes, and that we find and that we need not be alarmed, though we should find it not dull, it is regaining credit. Aeschylus, the grandest of the three tragedians, who had given us under a thin veil the first plantation of Europe, the Prometheus, is a poem of the like dignity and scope as the Book of Job or the Norse Edda. Of Plato I hesitate to speak, lest there should be no end. You find in him that which you have already found in Homer, now ripened to thought, the poet converted to a philosopher, with loftier strains of musical wisdom than Homer reached, as if Homer with youth and Plato the finished man, yet with no less security of bold and perfect song when he cares to use it, and with some harp strings fetched from a higher heaven. He contains the future as he came out of the past. In Plato, you explore modern Europe in its causes and seeds, all that is thought, which the history of Europe embodies or has yet to embody. The well-informed man finds himself anticipated. Plato is up with him too. Nothing has escaped him. Every new crop in the fertile harvest of reform, every fresh suggestion of modern humanity is there. If the student wished to see both sides and justice done to the man of the world, pitiless exposure of penance and the supremacy of truth and the religious sentiment, he shall be contented also. Why should not young men be educated on this book? It would suffice for the tuition of the race to test their understanding and to express their reason. Here is that which is so attractive to all men. The literature of the aristocracy, the literature of aristocracy, shall I call it? The picture of the best persons, sentiments, and manners by the first master in the best times, portraits of Pericles, Alcibiades, and the best times, Crito, Proteus, Protagoras, and Anaxagoras, and Socrates, which with the lovely background of the Athenian and suburban landscape, or who can overestimate the images with which he has enriched the minds of men, and which pass like bullion into the currency of all nations? Read the Phaedo and the Pythagoras, the Phaedrus and the Timaeus, the Republic and the Apologies of Socrates, and Plutarch cannot be spared from the smallest library. Thus, because he is so readable, which is much, than that he is medicinal and invigorating. The Lives of Simeon, Lycurgus, Alexander, Demosthenes, Phocion, Marcellus, and the rest are what history has of best. But this book has taken care of itself, and the opinion of the world is expressed in the innumerable cheap editions which make it as accessible as a newspaper. But Plutarch's Morals is less known and seldom reprinted. Yet such a reader as I am writing to cause, I'm sorry, such a reader as I am writing to can as ill spare it as the Lives. Sometimes his writing gets a little whacked, but he will read it. He will read in it the essays on the demons of Socrates, on Isis and Osiris, on the progress of virtue, on garrulity, and on love. And thank new and art of printing and the cheerful domain of ancient thinking. Plutarch charms by the facility of his association, so that it signifies little where you open his book, you find yourself at the Olympian tables. His memory is like the Isthmian. I'm sorry, I had to guess here. Isthmian Games, where all that was excellent in Greece was assembled, and you are stimulated and recruited by the lyric verses, by philosophic sentiments, by the forms and behaviors of heroes, by the worship of the gods, and by the passing of fillet, parsley, and laurel wreaths, chariot, armor, sacred cups, and utensils of sacrifice. I know I apologize for not noticing. I just ran out of my stream here, and so I'm a little over for those of you who may have been listening tonight. But I'm just going to continue this one page and then we'll end. An inestimable trilogy of ancient social pictures are the Three Banquets, respectively of Plato, Xenophon, and Plutarch. Plutarch has the least claimed historical accuracy, but the meeting of the seven wise masters is a charming portraiture of the ancient manners discourse and is as clear as the voice of a fife and entertaining as a French novel. Xenophon's delineation of the Athenian manners is an accessory to Plato and supplies traits of Socrates. Well, Socrates has merits of every kind. Plato has merits of every kind, being a repertory of the wisdom of the ancients on the subject of love, a picture of a feast of wits, not less descriptive than Aristophanes, and lastly, containing that ironical eulogy of Socrates, which is the source from which all the portraits of that head current in Europe have been drawn. And of course, a certain outline should be obtained of Greek history in which the important moments and persons can be rightly set down, but the shortest is the best, and if one lacks stomach for Mr. Grote's voluminous annals, an old, slight, and popular summary of Goldsmith or Gillies will serve. The valuable part is the age of Pericles and the next generation, and here we must read the Clouds of Aristophanes, and that was great. And what more of that master we gain appetite for, to learn our way in the streets of Athens and to know the tyranny of Aristophanes, requiring more genius and sometimes not less cruelty than that belonged to the official commanders. Aristophanes is now very accessible and much valuable commentary through the labors of Mitchell and Cartwright. An excellent popular book is G.A. St. John's Ancient Greece, The Life and Letters of Niebuhr, Niebuhr, even more than his lectures, furnishing leading views, and Wickelman, a Greek born out of a due time, has become essential to an intimate knowledge of the Attic genius. The secret of the recent histories in German and in English is the discovery, old wolves for wolf and ladder for Boeck, and the sincere Greek history of that period must be drawn from Demosthenes and especially from the business orations and from the comic poets. And I'm gonna stay there because what's so wonderful about this work is that you could spend a day Googling up all of these authors because you've never. In fact, I've spent some time Googling up some of these authors that he mentions that I've never heard of, and they're probably out of print. Many of them are. There are references to them throughout history and so on and so forth. But some of them are extremely obscure. And you got to remember when he wrote this, which was over 150 years ago, these authors were in print, or these were the in the Greek translations, or the European histories, or the American histories, or the authors of that time. So a number of these, it's fascinating if you have the time to go through some of these Greek as well as some of these European names and authors that he cites, and he does a remarkable job with this, because what he does is he's given us basically a bibliography just in this one essay of the greatest books that he ever read, things that made him that throughout his life that he read and gave great meaning to his works, and that's why his works last so long, because he's standing on the shoulders of these great men. He's using the language of these great geniuses, writers, the thoughts and ideas and elaborating upon them in his own genius to the extent of communing with God and nature and capturing the universal connection, if you will. And that's what I've always thought of Emerson as, the secular poet, prophet. Okay? The secular prophet. He's not a religious, he doesn't follow any specific religion. He gave up being a preacher and had a lot of difficulty with the Calvinist religion and so on with the many different religions. And he studied all of them, Eastern and Western, pagan, and all of these. And he formulated in his voluminous works, well, I thought a massive understanding, a unique understanding of a perspective that he was able to write about and to deliver to an audience and to deliver to the world this message. And I am so grateful for Emerson, as I hope so many people, as I know many, many people are, millions of people are, that he has inspired them and inspired many generations since he wrote these works. And all he's done is carry on. He'd be very humble and humbly admit that what he's done is basically what he just stated. It's anybody who reads a book should write down or should make public or should make known what he read, if he liked it or not. Write his reviews and say, this is worth reading, this is not worth reading, this is trash, you know, that kind of thing. Like, for instance, during the course of a week, I'll read maybe 1,000 articles. I mean, it doesn't seem like that, but yeah, I subscribe to so many different newsletters and magazines and books, and I get books and all kinds of stuff. But I get a couple of books a week just to review for my programs. New books every week, and some I toss away as tripe, and others I'm amazed at. I must bring forward and tell people about. So there's a responsibility as a reviewer and as a reader to present the best. And you don't have time to read the worst. So, you know, if I see something and I see an author, I mean, some authors I won't even bother reading. I see their name and they they're useless. Just as Emerson stated. But there are other authors or other writers that I'll pay some attention to, and I'll spend 5 minutes to read their article. And if I really like their article, I'll spend 5 minutes on my radio show to read the article. You know? Or, like I say, I'll spend an hour to read an excerpt of Emerson's essays. And with those words in mind, I'm going to thank you for listening tonight, and I'm going to ask that you join me again next week. We do not have a show tomorrow night, but we will be on next Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And we won't be on next Thursday. Sorry, this Thanksgiving. But we will be on I believe on Friday night with George Dixon. We'll find that out. I'm not certain, but I believe I spoke to him today, and I think he was able to do it. So I want to thank everybody, and I hope you enjoyed that. And again, say if you can ever read that. There's a wonderful website called RWE.org. That's Ralph Waldo Emerson.org, and it's got all of his writings on there, on that website, so you can look up. I'm pretty sure this is on there. The books is the his essay. If you're interested in that, and I want to thank everybody and wish you a good night.